fishes there.
I'm feeling embarrassed now. Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and may I begin by offering my profound apologies for the delay. I've been tied up at other matters. So I hope you've had plenty of time to eat your lunch, and you won't mind if I eat mine. It's going to be consequent. You all be very familiar, I think, with the Australian Parliamentary Fellow Scheme, which has been running now in the library for a long period of time. I think it's one of those great flagship things that the library does, producing not only people who can make a very significant distinction, contribution to the work of the library while they're here, but also making a very significant contribution in many cases to Australian scholarship. And so we've had, over the period of time we've been running the program, a large number of people who have published widely, have not only made a contribution to the library while they're here, but they've gone on to great success in academe and scholarship, and that's part of the reason why we continue the program. So this year we have a new parliamentary fellow, Joel Bateman, who has got what I think the committee decided when we were reviewing the applications this year, an entirely fascinating topic, particularly fascinating in the context of the times we find ourselves in, Joel, where, of course, we've not only had up until the 24th of November last year a large number of people who were in shadow ministries have had experience, of course, of being in shadow ministries, but we now have 9 months of a second period of shadow ministries and people who have suddenly found themselves in shadow ministries as a result of the events of last week. So it's a great pleasure to introduce Joel, to have him speak to you. He has a Bachelor of Arts and a PhD, and he is going to talk to us about his project, and I think once he has done that, and I've completed my lunch, we might have some discussion about some of the issues, I think. Is that the plan, yeah. Roxanne? Good. Okay. Well, I'll introduce Joel Bateman, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Senator Trude, and thank you, everybody else, for coming along this afternoon. And excuse my somewhat naff approach to the new PowerPoint from beginning. Excellent. Okay. I guess the first question... Oh, no, before I get to my first question, is what I'm actually going to be talking about today. And I'll try and keep this to reasonably brief, since we only have about an hour, and obviously the discussion and questions at the end is going to be the exciting bit, for me at least. The things I'll be talking about is, first I'll be looking at why I think it's important that Shadow Cabinet be studied and why I'm having a look at it this year, which will lead into a discussion of the existing material, or lack thereof. And then I'll start looking at the Shadow Cabinet and what it actually does. So some functions of it, how it operates through its procedures and practices, comparing it, and particularly the way it compares itself to Cabinet. And I'll finish off with a few random points, but points that don't fit into any of the above that are, I think, worth discussing. So the first question is, why look at Shadow Cabinet, and why am I talking about Shadow Cabinet? There's a few reasons for this. I should give a very quick bit of background, which was that I did my PhD on Australian political leadership and prime ministers, and got interested in that time at the sort of other side of the coin, the shadow ministry and leaders of the opposition. And sort of mentally bracketed it as something to look at some point in the future. And this position, the fellowship, seems like the ideal time to do that. And being now 8 or so months through it, I can say that in any other position, this particular research project would have been, if not impossible, very, very difficult. So I think that this position was a good fit to this sort of project. And as Senator Tribb alluded to, obviously, the timing of this was not entirely coincidental. I knew it was going to be an interesting time to look at questions of what the Shadow Cabinet does and how it operates and things like that. But as we all know, the Shadow Cabinet is in the news almost all the time. Over the last week or so, obviously, it has been particularly so, but even at times of relative political stability, the Shadow Cabinet as a body in Australian politics remains discussed a lot in the news. Individual members of it are often interviewed on shows like Insiders or Lateline or whatever on a regular basis and putting forward the opposition's viewpoint, attacking the government and whatever else. Yet for all of that, it's probably not a group very well understood. And while a lot of people who take an interest in politics would be able to name a lot of the members of the Shadow Cabinet and even their portfolios and things like that, there is not perhaps a lot of understanding of what it is that they actually do. And to some extent, that's a little bit true of Cabinet as well. Cabinet with its secrecy and notions of Cabinet responsibility and things like that is shrouded to some extent. But most people, I think, who take an interest in politics, and certainly most Australian politics scholars, have a good grip on what it is that Cabinet actually does and think it's worthwhile to talk about this and just discuss that. And the reasons for that are fairly straightforward, in that Cabinet is holds tremendous power in the Australian political system. Aside from the sort of media attention and focus on it, it is Cabinet, of course, that essentially runs Australian government in a lot of ways. Yet Shadow Cabinet has a relatively undefined role in the Australian political system. It's not quite as clear what it is that the Shadow Cabinet actually does, particularly in terms of how it operates, but also in terms of what its roles and functions within the Australian system are. And there's a lot of literature on the role of the opposition in democracies and parliamentary democracies in particular, but the role of the Shadow Cabinet as the sort of leaders of that opposition, plural, is much less defined and certainly much less discussed and studied. Cabinet, of course, is not in the Constitution in any real sense. The Executive Council is, but it's the relationship between Cabinet and the Constitution is fairly tenuous at best, and certainly in terms of what it actually does and how it operates and so forth is nowhere near the Constitution itself. Yet there are lots of other documents and policies and legislation and what have you that defines what it is that Cabinet ministers individually and Cabinet ministers collectively as the Cabinet actually do, and the notions of constitutional conventions and so on like that are fairly well established. Shadow Cabinet, however, operates in a much less clear zone. And in fact, there is no, in a sense, no real outlining documents of what it is that the Shadow Cabinet should do or how it should operate or anything like that. And there'll be a couple of little stories I'll tell later on that illustrate the ways in which that is so. So even quite basic questions about what it is that the Shadow Cabinet does remain not only unanswered, but in a lot of cases unasked. So in effect, my project is seeking to ask some of those questions and answer them as well. So that's sort of the general background to why I think this project is important in terms of those sorts of questions remaining, as I said, unasked. So, existing material. I knew from my previous studies into Australian politics that the material on Shadow Cabinet was fairly threadbare before I got here in February this year. It was only when I started devoting my working life to researching the Shadow Cabinet in Australia that I realised exactly how threadbare can be. Here, for instance, is the Oxford Companion to Australian Politics, which was published a couple of years ago, entry on the Shadow Cabinet for Shadow Ministry and Shadow Ministers. You can see it there underneath the column. They have no entry whatsoever. Most such books have a small one-sentence definition along the lines of senior front benches of the opposition, most of whom take a portfolio as spokesperson for the opposition. Something along those lines, very general sort of definition, a sentence or two at most, and maybe a passing reference when talking about the opposition in a more general sense. There has been, to date, no dedicated studies of the Shadow Cabinet in Australia, and most general Australian politics textbooks only passingly refer to it. Again, looking through these earlier in the year, a lot of the sort of introductory politics textbooks that we give to first year undergrads and others don't have Shadow Cabinet or any of the synonyms or constituent parts in the index, might have a passing reference when talking about the workings of Parliament. There'll be a couple of pages on the opposition, including a quick reference to the Shadow Ministry or to the Shadow Ministers individually. So I'm discussing that there are three levels of disregard in terms of Australian politics and the Shadow Ministry. The first one is official, which is fairly straightforward in that it's not, there are nowhere spelled out, as I've already mentioned, nowhere spelled out the ways in which the Shadow Cabinet should operate, how it should be chosen, how it, its members should work, those sorts of things. Those sorts of procedures are essentially made up by each incoming opposition or new leader of the opposition. Certainly when compared to things like the Cabinet Committee, which is a very detailed and for the last 20 or so years publicly available book that discusses the workings of Cabinet and Cabinet submissions and all that sort of stuff. The second one is academic, which I also already alluded to. In terms of most books simply passing over it, and some books passing over it entirely, most mentioning it only briefly and not really troubling to look at what it actually does, how it works, or what its roles or functions or importance might be. And the final is biographical, which is the one that did surprise me a bit more. Since the course of my PhD project did require a lot of reading of biographies and memoirs and diaries and so on for Australian politicians over the last 30 or 40 years. I had a vague inkling of some of them talking about Shadow Cabinet, but when I went back to look at them again, I was quite surprised. A lot of people who have subsequently written books on their time in politics have talked about their time in opposition in very similar terms, regardless of when it happened or what party they were from or other individual characteristics. A typical way of discussing your time in opposition is, surprisingly, in biographies of politicians and memoirs and so on, not all that dissimilar to the sort of stuff we see in the media every day anyway. It very much focuses on leadership instability, and who's backing who, on those sorts of questions, and very little attention is given to details of what they actually do when they meet, or what they do between meetings or anything like that. So a typical example would be discussing a meeting of the Shadow Cabinet, but instead of talking about what it is that they discussed or the manner in which they discussed it or how the meeting was run in any sort of way, it's discussed in the sense of, you know, the tension in the air because the leader was under pressure, or you know, various people within the Shadow Ministry competing with one another and things like that. A typical example from John Button's book, As It Happened, talking about Shadow Cabinet under Whitlam in the post-75 days after they lost the election then, in 75, he talks about the meeting in the basement committee room of the old Parliament House, and I quote, a dismal group in a gloomy room. And that's a fairly representative quote. Button's a better writer than most of them, but a fairly representative quote of the way that their time in Shadow Ministry was represented. And so therefore, I guess you can't get as much out of these books as you might have thought on what Shadow Ministry was actually like compared to again, books written in some cases by the same people on their time in cabinet itself, which in some cases go into excruciating detail of what cabinet does, and not just in terms of who is trying to become leader. Several leaders do talk, several former leaders of the opposition do talk a bit more about the pressures of that particular position. In particular, a couple of, less successful leaders of the opposition, like Bill Hayden or Bill Snedden, talk about the problem of being in opposition being that you're expected to oppose everything by supporters of your party. You're expected to oppose everything the government suggests. But you do so and you come under pressure from the public and the media and so on for just being relentlessly negative and whinging, and people tune out. So that sort of detail about the leader's lot as it is in opposition is one thing, but again, further details of how you choose what to oppose and how they make these sorts of decisions are generally left squarely in the realm of what the leader talks about as being politically prudent or whatever. So therefore, as I said, there's the three levels of writing about Australian politics that have more or less skimmed over what it is that the shadow cabinet actually does. Of course, the other level on a
all members of the Standing Committee on Communications are reminded of a private meeting followed by a public hearing commencing at 1 p.m. in Committee Room 1R4. Thank you.
I won't stop at the time. But the other way, of course, I guess I've also briefly mentioned, is generalistic reporting of the shadow ministry or the shadow cabinet, which, as we've all seen, particularly in the last few months, but at any given point in the last 50 years, shadow cabinet, when reported by the media, is a discussion of who is leader, who should be leader, who wants to be leader, who will never be leader, those sorts of questions. Okay, so moving on from that to a bit of a look at what shadow cabinet actually does. There's two roles that are usually given as the main roles for the shadow cabinet. The first one is to form the alternative government, and this was really the primary reason why the shadow cabinet developed in Britain 150 or 30 years ago. Was made up of members, senior members of the opposition, who wanted to organise the opposition itself. So this role includes managing the business of the opposition, as it were, deciding who will ask questions in question time, who will speak on individual matters and things like that, very much a mechanical sort of process. But also, in a broader sense, to maximise comparisons between themselves and the government, to say, at the next election, you will be choosing between that team and our team. A lot of that had to do with keeping the opposition on message, as it would be called, rather than having 60 or 70 people in the opposition, any of whom might speak on any given topic when asked by a journalist. The idea was very much of streamlining it, of saying, you know, if you want to know about our health policy or our response to the government's health policy, you speak to person X, who is our spokesperson for health. And so on. And that was very much to put in the minds of the public and through the media in particular, the idea that there is a direct comparison. One group of people might be in government at the moment and have the majority and hold executive power, but the other group just as easily could have. And we've got the same sort of people covering the same sorts of fields with our own ideas in each of those, obviously. And so that was very much an original version of something I will talk about again later, which was the cabinet and shadow cabinet comparisons that invite themselves all the time. So it's to give the public an idea of who they'd be voting for, and it's very much became formalised in Australia in particular post the Second World War, when the business of government did become more complicated and more detail intensive, and it became a matter of impossibility for every member of the party to be across the detail of every topic, and so it became much more important for one person to be identified as that party's spokesperson on that topic. That does lead, of course, to something that we do often hear about the shadow cabinet or the shadow ministry or the opposition in general, which is that they are a reactive body and really only do things in response to what the government has already done. My interviews that I've done with some shadow ministers over the last few months have suggested that most of them feel that that's a fairly true reading of the situation, that it is a largely reactive body. Obviously, there are different opinions on this, but for most people, that is sort of taken as a given. They say, well, of course we only ever react to what the government does. That's our job. We are the opposition. And don't see that as much of a problem and see it only becoming a problem if it's not carried out very well or is carried out without regard to the party's own duties in building alternative policies and so on. Some shadow ministers, current and former, have expressed to me a fair bit of distaste for that sort of work and say, I know it's important and I know we do need to respond to the government, but I think we've done it too much. I think we need to focus more on our own policies and things like that. Speaking in the current tense there, but that was certainly said to me by current Labour ministers talking about their time in the shadow ministry. The second role of the shadow cabinet traditionally has been a training and testing ground for future ministers. And this was also a role that grew out of shadow cabinet's earliest days, though perhaps has become more important over time, which is a way that, in as much as the shadow ministry is a way for the public and for the media as sort of intermediaries between politicians and the public to distinguish between various members of the opposition, it's also a way for the parties and particularly party leadership to look at their colleagues and say, who of these people might form government or might form cabinet should we win? Have a look at people's performance in the shadow role and see whether that's important or not. There are some problems with this that one or two authors have identified. The first one is that, well, the main one, the other one I'm really going to talk about today, is that there are quite different skills involved in being a shadow minister to being a minister. For instance, the shadow minister's major interactions are with Parliament and the media and the public, and try and convince all of those groups, that their version is better than what the government has done, or what the government is proposing to do. And that comes obviously back to the reactive role that I was just talking about. Whereas for the minister, they obviously have that same sort of role in some senses to argue for the reason why our case is better than the opposition's. But a large part of what a minister does, obviously, is within their own department and within their own cabinet, working within their department to bring forward various policy solutions and legislation and so on, and working within the cabinet to get those adopted and passed through the cabinet and then through the parliament. So that can be loosely categorised as shadow ministers needing to be primarily good debaters and salespeople, whereas ministers needing primarily to be good administrators. The other part of that, just very briefly, is that belonging to shadow cabinet or shadow ministry for even a decade or so brings you into very little contact with the processes of governance. You may get to debate the merits of policies and things like that, but the actual process of implementing and administrating legislation and so on is something that the shadow minister gets almost no contact with. And for that reason, one author in particular has suggested that, in fact, committee membership and belonging to various parliamentary committees is an equally good way of preparing for shadow ministry. On that topic, though, I have put that question to current and former shadow ministers whom I've interviewed, and most of them disputed it and said that they actually found their shadow ministry experience to be incredibly useful when they became ministers for Labour members, and coalition members have said the same in reverse, that they found their time in the ministry to be a good preparation for the time that they are now in the shadow ministry in terms of understanding what it is that ministers do. And some shadow ministers have told me that they feel like they have a better grip on the processes of being a minister than the actual current minister does, since they were in the ministry for a decade and their opponents have been in the ministry for 9 or 10 months. So certainly I think there is a bit of merit to this suggestion that the shadow cabinet and the cabinet have different skills required and different sorts of experience, but I think it's also important not to overstate those, and that a lot of current parliamentarians have found that their shadow ministry experience in putting together their own proposals and working out costings and things like that has actually been very useful in preparation for now being in cabinet. Okay, I'll just talk quickly about this stuff. It's fairly dry in a way, but as I said, as I said earlier, it is necessary. Meetings in shadow cabinet tend to be run on much the same sort of schedule as cabinet meetings. It was quite a deliberate attempt, I guess I should say at the beginning, that almost everything I'm about to say applies equally to both sides of both major parties. They seem to do things in fairly similar ways with only a few minor differences. But meetings do tend to be quite formal and are run on the same structure as cabinet meetings, less formal than cabinet, of course, and with fewer people in attendance. But other than that, fairly similar. Most of shadow cabinet's processes are modelled on those of the actual cabinet for a couple of simple reasons. Firstly, it's an obvious template for anyone wanting to run a shadow cabinet meeting is you have a look at the body it's emulating. And secondly, because a lot of the work they actually do is similar, and I'll get back to that in a moment. Confidentiality, I've been told by quite a few people in my interviews, is very important. It's very highly regarded by shadow ministers, simply because they have wide-ranging and often quite frank and open discussions about their party's policies and, equally importantly, I guess, their party's political standing and so on. And without any of the sort of formal mechanisms for secrecy that cabinet itself holds, shadow cabinet relies very much on the relationship between the people in the room and the idea of them all serving a common goal of triumphing over the government itself. But that was something that was stressed to me again and again and again in the interviews, that if you're worried about there being leaks out of the shadow cabinet meetings or shadow ministry meetings, the worth of those meetings plummets, because they need to have a very frank and fearless discussion of the issues, and particularly when political rather than policy issues are discussed. That was going to be very important. So the general structure is that the meetings tend to last about 3 hours approximately. They meet once a week during sitting periods and as required through recesses. As with cabinet meetings, they follow pretty much the same structure, and between the parties there is a bit of variance on the level of formality, and this also depended on the leader rather than the parties sometimes, but in terms of the level of formality and whether formal motions were moved and voted on and things like that, a lot of that came down to individual leader style rather than any other factor. They always begin with a leader's report, in which the leader of the opposition will discuss the opposition's current policy and political standing and how they're going, and that opens into a more general discussion of the opposition's place in the political world, and that word narrative came up a lot in descriptions of that part of the conversation, of how well the opposition's narrative is going and how well they're selling it and things like that. Then they will work through legislative business, so submissions by shadow ministers relating to upcoming legislation that's going to be brought for Parliament, particularly obviously in sitting periods. This forms the bulk of the meeting. The opposition's responses to government bills is discussed. And finally, discussion of policy matters in a more general sense, including private members' bills being considered by the opposition, party policy documents and discussion papers and things like that are all discussed. So the second half of that then is the Shadow Cabinet papers. Shadow Cabinet submissions are actually, again, very closely modelled on Cabinet submissions, so a lot shorter and with less detail. Various reasons, most of it is obvious. They do have one significant difference to Cabinet submissions, and a few Shadow Cabinet ministers did show me, though of course I wasn't allowed to take a key or anything like that, some Shadow Ministry submissions and Shadow Cabinet submissions. And the one significant difference they tend to have from Cabinet submissions themselves is that there is more of a consideration of parliamentary tactics in terms of there'll be a section on what the bill is trying to do and the background and the opposition's stance and so on, and then towards the end a section on what should we do when this is brought before Parliament. That's particularly important in times such as, well, actually most of the time recently, but especially in the first half of this year when the now opposition held a majority in the Senate. And one of the things they tended to talk about in these meetings was what should we do with this when it comes up in front of the Senate. Even now, of course, that would still be important in slightly different ways. Okay. Shadow Cabinet versus Cabinet. Now, the entire reason I'm doing a PowerPoint at all is because of this article. This was in yesterday's Australian. The detail of it's not important, though I have got a slightly closer blow-up of it. But this very much illustrates a point I've made throughout. We'll wait to speak in the future tense throughout my monograph and have talked a bit about here today, which is the way in which the Shadow Ministry is deliberately designed to place in minds of the media and through them the public the ways in which the two bodies can be compared. So the Australians really done the work for them here. Shall I go to the left of this one again? You probably can't read it, but again, the detail doesn't matter. But they've got, for each position, they have the government, cabinet member, and the shadow member, shadow minister. And it's called party face-off, how the front benches match up. And this was not a random case. I actually had another one of these from when Kevin Rudd became opposition leader. That was a year and a half ago. And a couple of papers did a similar thing with his new front bench, comparing Rudd's new team versus the Howard cabinet. And it is very much a case of demonstrating to the public the ways in which these compare, and it almost invites you to say, to go back a slide, which I can't do from immediate, but to look in a way and say, which of these two do I prefer? Kevin Rudd has those, according to the Australian, those five strengths and three weaknesses. Malcolm Turnbull has four strengths and three weaknesses. And I guess it's up to you as an individual voter to think about which of those matters the most to you, which of those strengths is important, which of those weaknesses you think would be fatal for whatever position that is of the leaders there, obviously, and Gillard versus the two people opposing her. But the point is very much one of comparing one to another, and just really reinforces the earliest reasons for Shadow Cabinet's existence and a large part of why it still works the way it does now. I am running a bit out of time, so I'll talk only very briefly about these two items. The reactive nature, as I said, mostly noted as being just part of what the opposition does and you can't get away with it, away from it, sorry. But it is also important to note that the reactive nature of the opposition is a little bit overstated. And a few shadow ministers, again current and former, have said this to me, that they would have been accused of being purely reactive in the media and what have you, when an equally valid way they consider of seeing it is we're making our own policy in relation to what the government has done, and sure, you're reacting to what the government has done, but you're also dealing with issues as they arise in the political sphere, and that's entirely natural and what they should be doing. So that reactive nature is a little bit less clear than perhaps sometimes the media would like us to believe. The other thing I was going to talk about under this general heading was the differences between the two positions, and this was one of the questions I enjoyed asking the most in the interviews I've done, given the time we are, asking people what they found to be the biggest difference when moving from shadow cabinet to cabinet or vice versa. The first point, for those who have worked in both, was that the main difference is one of access to information and resources, and that's not at all surprising, but this was one that came up in pretty much every interview I did, particularly obviously with the current shadow ministers. People who have spent 10 years in the ministry with considerable resourcing in terms of their own office, not to mention, of course, departments, and now working with staff of essentially of one advisor, specifically their portfolio. So that sort of thing was the one that a lot of them mentioned straight away when I asked about the biggest changes they found after the recent election. It's worth noting, though, something that did surprise me a little bit, and I certainly found interesting, was that not all of them saw this as a huge problem. Actually, some of them found it quite a positive. And I have to say, this was more so in the case of Labour members now working in Cabinet. And again, going back to an earlier topic, saying that the experience that they had in Shadow Cabinet working with one person in their office and with no access to the department and with very little resources other than one person in their office and the parliamentary library, they learned how to do things themselves. And a lot of them talked about the understanding that they feel they now have as cabinet ministers came about in large part because for the last decade, depending on experience, the last few years at least, they have written policy papers themselves and shadow cabinet submissions themselves with very little assistance, and having found that to be quite a useful means of preparing for government itself. The other thing, and related I guess, is that of workload. Most of the people I've spoken to found that the workload is significantly less in shadow cabinet than it is in cabinet itself. Though, again, some people disagreed with this and said, well, we process the same legislation that the cabinet does, so we have as much to do because we need to talk about everything they talk about, and we don't have all those resources and advisors available to us, so I work just as hard in shadow cabinet as I do in cabinet. So that was a slight bit of disagreement on that across some of them. Some of them said it was absolutely nothing whatsoever compared to cabinet. And particularly, again, current opposition members, some of them found that quite a remarkable change after a period of time in government. That's the end of the Okay, just very quickly, parallel processes is that it's important to remember that the shadow ministry is not the only body in the opposition. There are party committees, there are policy review committee, leadership group, obviously the opposition leader themselves have tremendous capacity to build policy and things like that. So it is a mistake to think of the shadow ministry as the only body within the opposition that's working on all of these things. Some of these things are in fact done a lot more by other groups such as the policy review committees. The shadow cabinet versus shadow ministry, I don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but Labour has traditionally in opposition run a general shadow ministry rather than a shadow cabinet, and so everybody, all shadow ministers go to every meeting, that sort of thing, and there's no designated shadow cabinet. That hasn't always been true, and particularly when Simon Crean was leader for a few years, he did have a designated shadow cabinet within the shadow ministry itself. Most of those I spoke to on the Labor side found that to be an unwise choice, and some felt that it contributed to the instability of a lot of Crean's leadership, with people, some of the junior shadow ministers feeling in a lot of ways to be left out and very isolated, particularly given the Labor Party's focus on the caucus meetings and things like that. There's these meetings for the shadow cabinet, the meetings for the whole caucus, but not a whole lot for the junior ministers who fit in between the two groups. Obviously, were members of caucus, but didn't seem to have much of a role outside of that, some of them felt. The resources thing I've already talked about, so I won't talk again. Stakeholders is one of the things that did surprise me, one of the topics that kept on coming up in interviews that I hadn't anticipated. A large part of what shadow ministers consider to be their role is to get to know the stakeholders in the field. And obviously, every portfolio has a different group of people who are important, but a lot of, particularly the Labor shadow ministers who had a lot longer have had a lot longer experience in the shadow ministry, talk about how one of the really important things they had to do was figure out who was who in their field, who to trust, who they should call and discuss things with, who they needed to meet and keep on side for publicity reasons and things like that. Particularly also given the lack of resources that we've thought about, the ability to have good relationships with important stakeholders in the field. Yeah, it can be quite important since they often do their own research and policies and formulate their own discussion papers and things like that, that shadow ministers can use as they see fit. And finally, the question of autonomy is important. This was another one that I was a bit, it wasn't surprised, I was unsure coming into it, how it was going to play out. Most shadow ministers talked about having quite remarkable autonomy when it came to dealing with issues in their portfolio. One of the questions I asked was based on some of the estimates hearings earlier in this year talking about letters to new ministers that Faulkner and a few others were asked about quite extensively in the Senate estimates earlier in this year. Which prompted me to ask about the arrangements for becoming a shadow minister. What happens? And without fail, 100% of the people I spoke to said, I got a call or whatever, I was told you are going to be shadow minister for X, good luck. And that was pretty much it, and there wasn't any more guidance. At most, a few of them had meetings with people in related shadow portfolios. The shadow minister for health would have a meeting arranged with the shadow minister for ageing, things like that. But that seemed to be the extent of almost all of them, and I would ask about how much consultation they thought they needed to have with the shadow ministry or with the leader of the opposition or anyone else in responding to government announcements, and most of them said, I would know what to do, I respond to it, and the important thing is to respond to it quickly to get it into the same news bulletin or news article or whatever. And very, very rarely did there be a case where I thought that I needed to consult too extensively with the leader or anyone else. So in a lot of these cases, I mean, part of the reality of that is that nothing, very rarely do things happen entirely unexpectedly in government, which means that very rarely do entirely unexpected things happen to the opposition. But it did mean that on most issues, most shadow ministers would not feel the need to, or indeed would not be encouraged to, consult with anyone before they responded through the media, through a press release or speech or whatever. So there was a fair bit of autonomy within the grounds of those sorts of things, and more broadly within the sort of policy review committee process. There was a bit more guidance in terms of long-term policy making. Anyway, I'm sure I've talked for far too long now, so I might wrap up. Look forward to some questions.
Thanks. Thank you. Thanks very much, John. Right, comments, questions? We have not a lot of time, but we're finishing at 1:30. So, anybody? Yeah.
the concept of a shadow cabinet first introduced into Australia, and what reason was given at the time for
That's not quite as straightforward a question as you might imagine, because, as I said, there's so little work has been done on it so far. Certainly, a broad, vague shadow ministry idea has been around since pretty much the beginning, since it had already existed in the UK and the system came over. It was only in the mid-60s, though, that it became what we know now as the Shadow Cabinet, and in the it was in 1965 that the Labour Party, then in opposition, voted to have a formal Shadow Cabinet type of institutional body, or whatever you want to call it, and specifically allocating portfolios to members and things like that. That was sort of a decision made only in the mid-60s by the Labour Party, and then the Liberals obviously had been in opposition for a long time at that point. Had been in government. So when they came into opposition, they sort of more or less inherited the system that Labour had set up over those years.
Joel, you spoke about, you opened by talking about the way that Shadow Cabinet was an institution that doesn't have a written history. And you spoke about its the omission of talk of the Shadow Cabinet in biographies.
Yeah.
Can you speculate on why it is you think they've been omitted? Is that because it's not...
From biographies to me?
From biographies. Is it because it's not deemed newsworthy? Or is it, to go back to that other notion you raised about narratives, is it not the narrative that people like to tell?
I think it's a bit of both of those. I think the reason for the academic disinterest in Shadow Cabinet is very much one of, it doesn't decide how the country is run, therefore it's not as worthy of study, which is why there's always much more work done on prime ministers than leaders of the opposition and governments than oppositions as well. I think for a large part of, particularly in memoirs and diaries and so on, I think a large part of it is wanting to get beyond that to the bit where you're in government. From the quotes I discussed and many others that I didn't, that theme of it not at all being an enjoyable experience, I guess, in a political sense, means that perhaps people just didn't want to dwell on it too much when, towards the end of their career, they were thinking about their career. The last thing they wanted to think about was the time where they had no real power and were, you know, constantly bickering over who should be leader and things like that. So I think it's a few of those issues together.
Thanks for the question, John. You mentioned the three levels of disregard Shadow Cabinet has had, one of which being the official level.
Yeah.
Just wondering, in your research, if you come across any views or suggestions that Shadow Cabinet should have some measure of official recognition, and if so, what form is that envisaged?
I haven't read much, I haven't found much of that at all. I think it comes back to a limited number of people talking about Shadow Cabinet at all. I don't know why that is. One story I did mean to tell was one of the interviews I had was with Peter Hendy, who was Chief of Staff to Brendan Nelson, as leader of the opposition. And he talked to me a lot about the processes and things like that and all of that. And a couple of things he said were really very interesting. One thing he said was that when a party has been in opposition and wins government and moves on to form government, or wins an election and moves on to form government, they slot into an existing structure. So this is how cabinet works and you fit into that. And they can tinker around the edges and whatever, but there is that. Whereas when you've been in government, you lose an election and you move to opposition, you effectively have to do the whole thing again. You have to, in a sense, reinvent the wheel. And one of the stories he told me was that just before the first meeting of the Nelson Shadow Cabinet, he realised they didn't know where they met, like where the Shadow Cabinet meet. So Peter Hendy called up one of Rod's staffers and said, when you guys were in opposition, where did Shadow Cabinet meet? And whoever it was said, oh, booked a committee room on the first floor of Parliament House. And he said, okay, good, thanks. And rang up and booked a committee room on the first floor of Parliament House, and that's where they had their meeting. So it is very much a case of do the bits you remember from when you were last in opposition and the bits from when you were in cabinet and you're trying to do the same sorts of things, as well as bits like that of just doing whatever's been done by the people who've been in opposition before you. So I haven't really seen anyone suggesting that it needed to be codified more or anything like that. But I think largely it's because people don't think about those things until it hits them.
We pushed it right for how submissions actually passed Shadow Cabinet to make sort of formal in the procedures?
Usually, very much through debates traditionally. I mean, some of them are very straightforward, as with cabinet submissions, are very straightforward, and everyone sort of has read it before the meeting and no one raises any objections, so they just tick off and move on to the next agenda. In general, though, they are, I mean, particularly for more contentious ones, they are debated quite extensively, sometimes over many weeks or months or whatever. Months they probably don't get the luxury of in Shadow Cabinet, I guess. Again, it is one of those things that is a choice to some extent of the leader and the party more generally on whether they're going to run with formal motions and passing them and things like that. So, Shadow Cabinet meetings tend to be minuted, but those minutes are more as a sort of a record for a memory tool rather than as an official record of what actually happens. And from what I understand, under both parties, it pretty much worked that they would debate each item, and if a consensus or a sense of the room, as it's usually called, was formed, then they'd go with that. If not, then it would return the next week and the week after for more and more.
It's 1:30, so I imagine we've all got to go on. I'll wind this up, but can I just make three quick points, which you may already have taken into account in your research, but the first I'd make is that, because members of Shadow Cabinet are not paid.
No.
They're not paid anything further for being in Shadow Cabinet. So it'd be interesting for you to explore, I think, what sort of dynamic that breeds or creates in the role of being Shadow Cabinet, if any. Yeah. It might mean that every member of Shadow Cabinet is an alpha male or woman and still determined to undertake their responsibilities and get into the cabinet eventually, and it makes no difference whatever. But it might also be a view that, my work ethic is commensurate with my remuneration. And there's some debate now about that. You may have looked into it, Joel, but it's an interesting dynamic, I think. And the second point is about autonomy. Of course, I don't know how the Labor Party works in this respect, but in my party, the autonomy is to a degree compromised by the extent to which shadow ministers are required to work through policy backbenches and so on. And I think
I didn't get to talk about that.
But you may have already got it factored into your study. But I think it's a useful dynamic, the relationship between the shadow minister and the backbench, and the extent to which, particularly when people are moving into areas of which they have absolutely no knowledge, which is quite frequent and manifest in recent appointments, I think, where they may or may not be more beholden to the policy committee than they would otherwise be. It may be a matter that changes over time, but I think it's probably worthwhile looking into. And the other thing it may be worthwhile looking at is backbenchers, people who, of course, aren't in Shadow Cabinet, but it's a question of whether or not they aspire to be in Shadow Cabinet, or whether or not they think, why would I do that? I mean, I get no more pay, I've got to work harder, I'd be much more satisfied if I concentrated on the things that I'm interested in and in due course work through. But I suspect that perhaps many backbenchers say, well, if I want to be in the cabinet or the ministry later on, then this is a necessary gate through which I have to pass. So 3 points that may or may not be of of interest. Sorry. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming today. Again, I apologise for the late start. Most interesting presentation, Joel. I think I really, really look forward to the study appearing when it does. And I wish you well with your research, and I'd ask you to thank you for spending.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're taking time out of an incredibly busy day.
Where am I going now? What's it called by?
Yeah, well, just to get it signed, they want to fit it in today. Would you rather I just tell them that it's giving us a
book? Well,
no, I'm so stupid.
Unless you had a spare copy, and I can.
Yeah, and you can swap it over.
Well,
that was stupid of me.
Well, do you mean now?
Yeah, now. Yeah. I could go and get it and meet you there with it if you want. It's 152. And then they've also called a meeting for 10 to 2 for the constitutional committee to look at the draft report for the evidence.
Absolutely. That's what they're called. I couldn't remember what they're called. Yeah.
They're certainly very firm on that, and I know that everything is in the shadow of the now. All that does.
Thanks. That was extremely good.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for coming. No, not at all. So they're all heavily reliant on this. And that's why they've asked the Labor Party, because the Labor Party have just been haphazard about it and have not done it. But I even know now from the restructure, everyone has a definite responsibility and very, very structured about that.
Well, part of what I had heard from Labor Coalition members was about, to an extent, knowing that this policy review committee process was happening, but for most of them it hasn't had much of an impact on them yet. It's like it's sort of a long-term process. Let's say, I know in years to come, that will become important, and they'll tell me more about what I need.
But because it's political now, not bureaucratic, the coalition are not going to release their policies because, from a political point of view, they're saying that the government have stolen everything they've done over the last 10 years, so why give them any more fuel, because they're not smart enough to think about these things themselves. Another analogy, and this is the last thing I'll say before I go, that people have used to describe what it's like, and having worked in government now in opposition, people say that opposition is like childbirth. It's the pain you have to have, and as soon as it's over, people don't want to go back there. It's just far too painful. I mean, you've got what you've got as a result of that, but people don't think about it because the pain is so great.
it's pretty true, actually. Yeah. And